When I was a boy in Scotland, I was fond of everything that was wild, and all my life I've been growing fonder and fonder of wild places and wild creatures. I have been a wandering wilderness lover with never a thought or dream of fame, while humbly trying to trace and learn and enjoy nature's lessons. That's how visionary naturalist John Muir described himself. He decided to leave the University of Wisconsin for what he called the University of the Wilderness. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Born 175 years ago, John Muir has been called the father of the national parks, founder of the Sierra Club, a pioneering conservationist, an adventurer, philosopher, author, inventor, and activist. Although he did most of his adult work in California and other areas of the Far West, he grew up in Wisconsin. How did Muir's Scottish roots and Wisconsin years shape him? How did Muir's approach to nature change the world? Joining us to explore John Muir is Daniel Einstein, Historic and Cultural Resources Manager for the UW-Madison's Campus Planning and Landscape Architecture Division.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Glad to be here.
When I think of John Muir, the first thing I think of with those Scottish roots, and it must be based on some things that I read somewhere, that probably from the story of my boyhood and youth that he wrote, is just how grindingly hard and generally unpleasant much of his early life was.
John Muir came to Wisconsin but a year after the state had been declared, and he describes his adventure as being on the edge of the wilderness. His was the story of a frontier homesteading family, and that was made all the more difficult by what some people would say was a tyrannical father who forced him to work long hours in the field. It was a difficult life, but I think it was one that prepared him well for his adventures that he would take out west towards Alaska and the Arctic and South America.
Endurance.
He was a tough man.
Endurance and self-reliance.
Frugality, tenaciousness, were all character-building qualities that I think he got from his time in Wisconsin.
Intriguing that he was, his father was a vegetarian, a fairly fierce one, right? And pretty much forced the rest of the family into that mold, for better or worse.
He was a disciplinarian, perhaps even dictatorial in his outlook. He chose to bring his family from Scotland in no small measure to exercise greater religious freedom, which is a little ironic because that religious freedom was restrictive in many ways. Disciples of Christ was the denomination that he was most closely associated with, although I understand he joined many Christian denominations and participated in many what some people would call fads. The Graham bread diet was one of the fads that he imposed on his family. This was a vegetarian diet, but it also required that you abstain from alcohol and meat, all to harness your lust and impulsiveness. And so not only was it vegetarian, but sometimes all they were eating was a Graham bread flour once a day.
And so they never would have been hunters either, then, I assume. Would that be right?
I believe the only time that the family hunted was for a deer on the Hickory Hill farm, and that was by his younger brother. So no hunting. It was primarily a simple diet, although after the children were showing signs of starvation and the neighbors were complaining about how gaunt and weak the children looked, the father was persuaded that since there were references to biblical characters eating meat, maybe it would be okay for his family to eat meat as well.
The father also suggested reading nothing but the Bible and that novels were trash, right? As far as I know.
Novels were the spawn of Satan.
Yes.
Some of them probably are.
Well, he did require that all of his family study the Bible, and John was able to memorize the entire New Testament, which in some of the confrontations with his father came in handy because he could argue his father better for knowing the verse. But John was always curious, had a voracious appetite for knowledge, and despite the restrictions, he was able to borrow books from neighbors, and they were always looking out for the Muir children because I think the neighbors were concerned about how this family was being run. And he hid the books in the basement and was able to teach himself algebra and trigonometry and the laws of physics all on the sly.
That's maybe one of the more moving parts, I think, of the story of my boyhood and youth, and the things that he's written about his background is just the way he writes about the treasure of time. Like if he had been working, you know, plowing fields or doing hard labor, splitting rails, that if he could borrow some time in the middle of the night to read, to study, how rich that made him feel.
You know, it's said that he would carry books into the field and during pauses in the workday, which are sometimes described as lasting for 17 hours, he would be out in the fields having but a Sunday off and two holidays, New Year's and the 4th of July. And he would read in the field, or he would do math problems in the dirt. He'd also take his whittling knife out in the field, where he would whittle and create some of his early inventions. There's this wonderful story, though, about pleading with his father for some additional time to study. And finally, his father relents and tells him that, well, as long as you don't take any hours out of the workday, you can rise as early as you please. And on your own time, you can study and work on your inventions. And so that very night, John wakes himself up at 1 o'clock in the morning and is delighted by the prospect of having 5 extra hours in the day in which he can do his studies and work on his inventions.
That's so amazing, I guess, that just that hunger to learn and the curiosity that he seems to have been born.
This goes on until he's in his early 20s, doesn't it?
Well, he works on the farm until he is 22, which is long after most sons would be still working on the family farm. Ordinarily, they would have married and started off on their own. But family was very important to John Muir, and it was difficult for him to leave his family.
What was his mother like? We always hear about the tyrannical father and so on, but any influence from that side and any sort of impact of those years in Scotland before coming to this country?
His mother was perhaps typical in so much as in the mid-1800s, the wife was often the nurturing parent who yielded to the head of the household, the man. She certainly did encourage his education, and when his father would not support his pursuits at higher education, she would often slip a gold coin to him to support his interests, whereas his father would refuse to pay him or to support him.
Did he have any nostalgia for the land, the farm that he was leaving?
Well, there were two farms. When they first arrived in Wisconsin, they established a farm at a place just south of Montello. It's about 50 miles north of Madison. But let me tell you just quickly the story of how they traveled from Scotland and this epic journey. When John was 10 years old, his father announces quite abruptly one evening, "Forget your studies. Tomorrow you're not going to school. We're off to North America." They were delighted by this, of course, and with two of his siblings, the father takes the family on a boat trip across the Atlantic. He wasn't certain where he wanted to go as a British citizen. He thought that he might go to Canada. He had heard that it would be possible to farm in Canada. But on the trip over, which lasted 6 weeks, he talks to some fellow emigrants and grain merchants who tell him that Canada is not an easy place to farm, that Canada is too thickly wooded. But if you go to Wisconsin, where the prairie and the openings would allow you to plant a crop in your very first year, you could be prosperous. And not only that, there was this area right on the edge of two great watersheds, the Mississippi Basin and the Great Lakes. And it's only separated by a small area that could be forded by a canal, and that canal would be built soon. And if you were a grain merchant, you could then access markets all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and out through the St. Lawrence to the Atlantic. And so the father, who was always looking to make more money, he was actually quite a prosperous merchant in Scotland, thought, Wisconsin, that would be the place for me. So rather than Canada, the family boards a boat, travels up the Hudson River, across the Erie Canal, boards a steamer in Buffalo, and makes their way to Milwaukee. They get on an ox cart, and they head to the west, where they acquire this first property near Montello.
And what kind of 160 land? 160 acres.
160 yeah. acres, right.
How good was that land?
Well, let me read to you what Muir writes about this farm they call Fountain Lake Farm. His father had gone ahead and had built a small hut for the family out of bur oak logs and hand-hewn white oak planking for the floor. He writes, "To this charming hut in the sunny woods overlooking a flowery glacier meadow and a lake rimmed with water lilies, we were hauled by an ox team across trackless carex swamps and low rolling hills sparsely dotted with round-headed oaks. This sudden plash into pure wildness, baptism in nature's warm heart, how utterly happy it made us, nature streaming into us, wooingly teaching us her wonderful glowing lessons. Here, without knowing it, we were still at school, every wild lesson a love lesson, not whipped, but charmed into us. Oh, that glorious Wisconsin wilderness."
Hmm.
Kind of flowery.
Yeah,
literally.
He writes very poetically.
Yes. You know, I think it's important to put this a little bit in perspective. Although coming from the civilized British Isles, entering the Wisconsin frontier was to him like wilderness. But it's important to remember that that's a Eurocentric perspective, mm-hmm. that Wisconsin had been settled for 12,000 years by Native Americans, and that their activities on the land had shaped it in many ways, hunting out the megafauna, burning the prairies, keeping the grasslands intact. So Native Americans were the first pioneers of this land. But
and what did Muir think of Native Americans that were already there and their culture and their approach to the land?
He does write a little bit about some of the Ho-Chunk people that visit their homestead in those very early years. At the time, most of the Indians in the region had been pushed out to across the other side of the Mississippi, but some had filtered back. But these were impoverished people. These were folks who were having a difficult time making a life for themselves from the land, having been pushed off. And so his initial encounters with the native people were when they came to the house to beg for food or to perhaps borrow a tool. And so he was scared, but also sympathetic towards the native people. And as his life moves forward, he has many more experiences with native people and grows to appreciate and understand how the native people had been swindled from their land.
Does he have a sense on this farm, this Fountain Hill Farm, or the second one that they acquired, that there are parts that should be preserved rather than worked?
You know, he loved this farm. They lived there for about 8 years, and I think it's a key formative stage in his life. And before he moves from Wisconsin, he tries to acquire the property. It had been managed by his brother-in-law. And he writes many years later about an attempt to preserve this property. And some of his biographers are quick to note that this is 25 years before any of his wilderness preservation attempts on the West Coast in the Sierra Nevada and Yosemite. So this idea of preservation comes to him as a young man. And he writes in a speech, and I think this is, it's all prescient. Saving bits of pure wilderness was a fond favorite notion of mine long before I heard of national parks. When my father came from Scotland, he settled in a fine region of Wisconsin beside a small glacier lake. And when I was about to wander away on my long rambles, I was sorry to leave the precious meadow unprotected. Therefore I said to my brother-in-law, who by then owned it, "Sell me the 40 acres of Lake Meadow and keep it fenced and never allow cattle or hogs to break into it, and I will gladly pay you whatever you say. I want to keep it untrampled for the sake of the ferns and the flowers, and even if I should never see it again, the beauty of its lilies and orchids is so pressed into my mind I shall always enjoy looking back at them in imagination."
That sounds like Wordsworth a little bit. I wonder if he had read some of Wordsworth's things where you can keep the image of nature in your mind long after you've left it.
Well, he was certainly familiar with many of the romantic writers, Emerson and Thoreau, and he studied the classics while at the university.
So what was the outcome of this attempt at preservation?
Well, his brother-in-law did not choose to sell the property. And years later, he returns and he says that he found the deep water pond lilies in fresh bloom, but the delicate garden sod of the meadow was broken up and trampled into black mire. And so he was quite disappointed. In 1957, the Marquette County purchased part of this original homestead and has now established John Muir Memorial Park. An adjacent section of the original homestead is now owned privately and has been declared a National Historic Landmark because it includes the original home site. The house is long gone, but one can still go there, and through ecological restoration efforts, prairie has been reestablished, and we can imagine what it might have looked like when John Muir was there as a young man.
What did he try to grow on that farm, the family, at the Fountain Lake Farm?
At the Fountain Lake Farm. Well, it's interesting. At the time, this is, again, the 1850s. The primary agricultural crop in Wisconsin was wheat. And what they found out in a very short time is that wheat exhausts the soil. And indeed, the soils at the Fountain Lake Farm were either sandy and infertile, or they were soggy because of the sedge meadows and the bogs. So they exhausted the farm in a very short while. Indeed, it wasn't until the 1860s and 70s that agriculture in Wisconsin shifted to dairying in response to all of the wheat failure in Wisconsin.
Was there a realization at some point in this part of Muir's life that everything indeed is connected, and even if you're interested in farming, you have to keep an eye out for the whole ecosystem of that farm, or else it will play out?
You know, I think there were many examples of life lessons, observing what happens when people do not care for the land. And certainly exhausting that first farm and not caring for the larger ecosystem. You know, there's a wonderful analogy that one of the reasons that wheat failed in Wisconsin is that when you cut the trees, which harbor the birds, which eat the larvae, which then grow into bugs that eat the wheat, you've got this cascading effect. And one needs to always take into account this complexity of the web of life. You know, later he creates what he calls his scythe clock, which I think is a wonderful little invention that is emblematic of his evolving ideas about the interconnectedness of things. He loved to whittle and he loved to create. And one of his very first inventions was a mechanical clock where he would hand carve intricate gears with small cogs, and he would mount these gears on the blade of a scythe. A scythe being that tool that one uses to harvest wheat.
Yeah, hand.
It's a mowing tool. Mm-hmm. The Grim Reaper and Father Time carry one of them around. And so he mounted these gears on the blade of his scythe and suspended a cord from the gears to create a pendulum that he made out of copper arrows pounded out of spare pennies. And the pendulum would drive the gears, and one could actually count the seconds, the minutes, and the hours on his scythe clock. But what's really interesting about this particular invention is that he whittles on the handle, the snathe of the scythe, the words, "All flesh is grass," which is a biblical verse. And it suggests an awareness of fleeting time. Certainly, vanity was one of the themes that his father beat into him, that you may be flesh today, but tomorrow you're going to be grass. So there's the ephemeral nature of existence. But you could also take it to mean that life is eternal and immortal, because although you may be flesh today, tomorrow you feed the worms, which nourishes the grass, which feeds the cow, which nourishes you. And it's a metaphor for that ecological principle of the carbon cycle, that everything is connected and everything goes round and round. And one of his most often cited quotes is, "When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. One fancies a heart like our own must be beating in every crystal and cell, and we feel like stopping to speak to the plants and animals as friendly fellow mountaineers." These philosophical perspectives began as a boy in Wisconsin, working the farm.
We'll follow John Muir to Madison and beyond when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Daniel Einstein, and we are talking about the naturalist John Muir, particularly his early years in Wisconsin. You mentioned that he was an inventor. We were just talking about his scythe clock. And I know one of the inventions that I read about that has stayed in my head for decades is this notion of the early rising bed that would somehow be like an alarm clock built into a bed that would throw you out, which I always thought as when my children were teenagers would be useful in the morning to get them up and out the door to high school.
Well, like most adolescents and young people, John would rather sleep in late, but that was not allowed. And he invented the early rising machine while still living on the farm. He built many clocks. The scythe clock was just one example. But he had another clock mechanism, which he connected to what he called his early rising machine. And this was a bed that had three legs, two positioned towards the head, and a third leg in the center of the bed. And this central leg was hinged. It was an elbow that was held in place with a sturdy wooden peg. And to this sturdy peg, he attached a cord, which then was linked to a counterweight. And so he could set the clock to release an escapement, a little lever, which would drop the rock, which would pull the cord, which would yank the peg out of the elbow leg, and the bottom of the bed would fall to the floor, and the sleeper would tumble down.
He got there before Rube Goldberg.
It's a wonderful, wonderful machine. And actually, there are accounts of him trying to patent the idea later in life. And he made some money crafting these little beds for folks in Madison. I've yet to see a sketch of this invention, and perhaps in somebody's attic in Madison is an example. But I'd love to make one of them someday.
What inventions of his do we have that have endured or have been recreated?
Well, probably one of his most famous inventions was his study table, which he created while a student here on campus. And this study table, again, was at its core a clock with some drive mechanisms. So he had a study table top, which had a slot in it. And beneath that tabletop was a bookshelf. And he could set his clock mechanism to drive a piston, which would push a book up from the shelf below the study table, and it would appear, and the book would flop open, and he would study for a prescribed period, often as little as 15 minutes, at which time the clock would allow the piston to retreat, the shelf would rotate a few inches to the left. The piston then would drive the next book up through the bottom of the table, and he could begin his studies again. Apparently, he needed this sort of external discipline because his mind would wander. He would much prefer rambling about the countryside. And so apparently he invented a locking mechanism, which once his study table was engaged, would continue to flop books on the table. And in this way, he would have to stay there and study.
What kind of reputation did he have at the UW-Madison? We're talking 1860 by now.
And tell us how he got there, too.
What did the other students think of him?
Well, yeah, let's back up just a moment. He lived on the farm for about 11 years, and at age 22, he's getting a little bit anxious. He's well known in the community for his inventions, and one day a neighbor comes by and announces that in Madison there will be the state fair. This is September 1860, and if he would gather up some of these inventions, he could go down to the fair, and certainly by exhibiting his inventions, somebody would want to hire him as either an inventor or an engineer. And this is the final push that allows him to sever ties with his family. He travels down to Partyville, a train depot 9 miles from his home. And he writes that he never had entered Partyville, though it was just a few miles away. So constrained was his farm life. He boards the train, which he had not seen or ridden on since leaving Scotland. And the conductor, seeing his satchel of bits and pieces of gears and levers, is immediately impressed and suggests that maybe he would like to go on the engine of the locomotive, which, of course, he's fascinated to see this bit of technology. And he's invited to enter the locomotive engine, but that's not enough. He asks if he can climb out onto the engine, and he's given permission, and he scrambles out the side of the locomotive, and he watches the wheels and the gears turning, and then positions himself out on the front of the engine, on the cow catcher. And that's how he rides into Madison.
Head of his own parade.
The head of his own parade. He gets to Madison. The state fair is on the property that would subsequently become Camp Randall, the Civil War training grounds. But at the time, it was a fairground. And he's invited to display his inventions in the Fine Arts Hall. The Fine Arts Hall was a structure that would have been located on a knoll, roughly where the football stadium bleachers along Breeze Terrace are located today. Immediately, his inventions attract a lot of attention. Newspapers publish articles about the genius Whittler and and the inventions that he's brought to the state fair. He had with him his scythe clock, his early rising bed, and a thermometer that he had fashioned out of a washboard, which apparently was so sensitive that even the approach of a single person would activate the needle. So he was a big success at the fair and wins a $15 prize, which doubles the amount of money he has in his pocket for his first foray out into the world.
And what kind of attention did he get from people in term, and how does that help him get to the university?
Well, there were, I think, 20,000 people. This is 1860. The state fair was even at that time a big draw. So he got all sorts of invitations from factory owners and inventors and met students. In fact, this is when he meets Jean Carr. And for those that are familiar with his life, Jean Carr plays an important role as a mentor and introduces him throughout his life to literary contacts as well as political contacts. Jean Carr is the wife of a professor of natural history and chemistry. Well, he's offered many jobs, but takes one, and that is to work with an inventor who has created what everyone believes will be the next great technological advancement, and that is a steam-driven ice-breaking boat. And so he follows this inventor to Prairie du Chien because he thinks he can learn from him, but the project fails when the boat sinks. So he wanders back to Madison, and he's moping about town, not knowing quite what to do. His great adventure has sort of fizzled. And he wanders over to the university, which at the time had just three buildings, North Hall, South Hall, and what was referred to then as the main edifice. Now we know it as Bascom Hall. And he is enticed and enthralled, but he doesn't quite know how to make his way into the university. And he later writes, "No university, it seemed to me, could be more admirably situated, and I was sauntering about it, charmed with its fine lawns and trees and beautiful lakes, and saw the students going and coming with their books and occasionally practicing with a theodolite and measuring distances. And I thought that if I could only join them, it would be the greatest joy of life. I was desperately hungry and thirsty for knowledge and willing to endure anything to get it." Well, he bumps into a student and he says, "How do I get into this place?" And he says, "Well, it's really not all that hard, you know. Just go over and talk to Professor Stirling," for whom Stirling Hall is named, who was the acting chancellor at the time, and plead your case. And he said, but how will I eat?" And he said, "That's no problem. A milkman comes every day, and you can feed yourself on milk and bread, and you can do it for $1 a week." And so John approaches Stirling and recites a little Latin and Greek, which he has taught himself, and some French, which he remembers from his grammar school days. By the way, he never went to school once he arrived in Wisconsin, but for a few terms, because he could not be spared from work on the farm. And after a few weeks in what they called the preparatory school, he is enrolled as a full student. No SATs, no GPA.
Did he have to pay tuition?
He did have to pay tuition, but his father did finally send him a little money because he finally came around. I think his mother was coaxing that. He finally comes around and helps him with enrollment. He has two primary instructors, Ezra Carr, from whom he learns geology and chemistry. Professor Sterling teaches him physics, and from Professor Butler he learns the classics. And these three men, I think, again, are part of this foundation that allows Muir to eventually move out into the world. He learns how to write. He learns how to interpret the landscape, to examine the geology and see how the glaciers have formed the Wisconsin landscape.
What about botany? I mean, does he have a systematic approach to botany?
You know, the story of Muir's botany lesson is often told, and one which gets a little bit confused in his autobiography. You know, Muir was a great writer. I think 300 articles and 10 books in his lifetime, and a number of books coming out posthumously because he kept notebooks. He recorded his travels, all encouraged by Professor Butler here on campus. And so the story of his first botany lesson is told in his autobiography, but it's in a condensed version and a little bit over-dramatized, but worth retelling. There was a fellow student named Griswold, and he writes in his autobiography that one memorable day in June, when I was standing on the stone steps of the North Dormitory, Mr. Griswold joined me and at once began to teach. He reached up, plucked a flower from an overspreading branch of a locust tree, and handed it to me and said, "Muir, do you know what family this tree belongs to?" "No," I said. "I don't know anything about botany." "Well, no matter," he said. "What is it like?" "Well, it's like a pea flower," I replied. "That's right. You're right," he said. "It belongs to the pea family." "But how can that be?" I objected. "When the pea is a weak, clinging, straggling herb, and the locust a big, thorny hardwood tree." "Well," Muir goes on to write, "this fine lesson charmed me and sent me flying to the woods and meadows in wild enthusiasm." You know,
once he got sprung out of bed.
Yeah, once he gathered himself from that lump at the bottom of the bed. But here is this seminal experience. You know, Muir had been always aware of nature. He had always been looking at plants. And when he says, "I know nothing of botany," he doesn't really mean I don't know nothing about nature. What he meant is, I had no idea about the systematic plant science of botany, taxonomy, the reproductive functions of the different plant parts. And obviously, he's got a mechanistic view of the world, and this fascinates him, that there are parts to the plant and that there are ways of understanding how plants reproduce.
And if he loved the University of Wisconsin so much and he was so hungry and thirsty for knowledge, why is it he never finished?
You know, that's an interesting story. The backdrop to his time here on campus, which is early 1861 to 1863, is overshadowed by the Civil War. It was, a month or two after he arrives here that the shot at Fort Sumter is heard. And immediately, many of his classmates drop out of school to join the military. And he resists the military, and it plays an important role in the next few years of his life. But let me just tell you briefly that the state fairgrounds are transformed into a military camp. Camp Randall is a military term. And he talks about visiting not only his fellow students, but some of his friends from back home who come to Camp Randall to receive their first military training, and he's appalled. His sensibilities are I don't know, he's disturbed by the behavior of these young men at camp. Not only do they swear, they drink alcohol, they visit prostitutes, but worse yet, they are all worked up about killing fellow humans. And this is abhorrent to him. He ministers to them, and he tries to encourage them to be principled. Indeed, later in the war, he visits Camp Randall, where the sick and wounded have been brought. And it's at that time that he thinks he's going to become a doctor, because he wants to help heal the suffering. And so in 1863, he returns back to the farm where the family is still working, and he's unsure about his future. He thinks that he's going to enroll at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor to become a doctor.
Is the draft not an issue?
The draft is one of those overarching questions. No more volunteers are coming forward to serve, and a draft is imposed in 1863, a draft that was opposed both in Milwaukee by the German community as well as the Irish community in the riots in New York City. The country is not only split by the North and the South.
It's fragmented.
Across the North. In fact, the climate on campus is a difficult one. We think about the Vietnam War and how divided that made the campus in the 1960s and 1970s. It was similar here on the campus during the Civil War. Nonetheless, he waits to see if his name is going to be drawn for the draft of 1863. Rather than move to Michigan, where he thinks the prospects of being drafted might be worse than in Wisconsin because each state is handling the draft, he sticks around and his number is never called. And he stays through the winter and pledges that when he sees the first flower, he will leave on his first botanical ramble. And on February 28th, he sees his first flower, and 2 days later, he heads north to Canada to join his brother, who, in the words of the day, had already skedaddled across the border. And so many biographers take the timing of his departure to mean that he was a draft dodger. But several of his biographers are pained to point out that, no, he waited to hear if his number was called, and it was not called, and it was only then that he leaves for Canada. But one can imagine if he had been called, how difficult it would have been for him to decide to join the war or not.
More on John Muir when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Daniel Einstein. We're talking about John Muir, a towering figure among environmentalists and Sierra Club members. He was, after all, a co-founder of the Sierra Club. Still thought primarily, I think, as a man of the West, isn't he, John Muir, despite his roots in Wisconsin and Scotland?
You know, I often think that there's a botanical metaphor that is appropriate for Muir's life arc. You know, he was sprouted in Scotland, but then transplanted to Wisconsin, where he was nourished by Wisconsin soils. He sets seed, which he then scatters across the West. So he finally does make his way out west and establishes himself in the Yosemite Valley, where he lives for nearly 10 years, and finally settling down in Martinez, California, where he manages a fruit farm. While he's known for his exploits out west, his travels to Alaska, his travels to the Arctic, South America, his roots start in Wisconsin. But most people, and most biographers, interestingly, skip over the Wisconsin years and focus on that time out west.
And what is he advocating once he gets out to the west, which has still seemingly this unlimited potential, if we're talking about the 1860s and 70s?
Right. Well, as I say, he moves to Yosemite Valley, and he works for a while in a sawmill, and he's a shepherd, and he sees that even though some of this land has been set aside and is managed by the government, it's being overgrazed, and that livestock is being allowed to trample the high Sierra meadows. And the logging that is occurring in the Sierra Nevada range where he travels is causing great tumult and erosion and catastrophe, ecological catastrophe. And it's during this time that he starts both his travels as well as his writing. He writes for a number of magazines, again, encouraged by Gene Carr, who has now moved out to the University of California, and so they maintain this mentoring relationship and extensive correspondence, which is the source of a lot of the biographies that are subsequently written about Muir.
So he becomes primarily a land management advocate rather than an advocate of just setting land aside and not using it at all.
Well, there's an interesting development in the conservation movement of this time. There were two main figures, Gifford Pinchot, who was leading the newly formed Forest Service, and he had a perspective on conservation that although we ought to be concerned about our natural resources, sustainable use, wise use of those resources is the appropriate approach. John Muir and his followers in his camp take a different approach. So we've got the utilitarian Forest Service Gifford Pinchot branch of the conservation movement, and then we have John Muir and the Sierra Club, which look to finding ways to set aside and preserve these wild places. And he famously advocates for the establishment of a number of national parks, Yosemite, Mount Rainier, Sequoia, Grand Canyon, Petrified Forest. All of these places were advocated for by John Muir, which earns him the title Father of Our National Parks.
And he chooses for the motto of the Sierra Club, the Thoreau line, in wildness is the preservation of the world. So he's certainly right from his boyhood love of wilderness and the wild. He continues that championing of the wild. He writes in My Summer in the Sierras that he didn't understand why you would cut down trees to build a church when you could go to what he calls the cathedral of the wilderness. He always maintains a kind of spiritual connection to nature, does he not?
You know, his religious upbringing is a source of both inspiration and, I think, you know, a lot of the tug and pull. As I say, my interest has been in examining Muir's development in Wisconsin and his youth, and there's so many interesting parallels with college students today. You know, he's rejecting some of the belief systems that were imposed on him by his father. He's trying to figure out a life philosophy. He's living in poverty. He's being molded, if you will. The spiritual aspect is an interesting one, which appears in all of his writings. He speaks of God in a kind of spiritual and transcendental way. His religious practice was certainly not as severe as his father's, but he does see in nature God's hand.
Places in Wisconsin that are still associated with John Muir?
Well, the original Fountain Lake Farm is now a state natural area, national landmark. Here on campus, we have Muir Knoll, which is that area just across from North Hall, where he had his dormitory room. The adjacent wooded lot is John Muir Park. Old timers may remember that it was called Bascom Woods up until the 1960s, when as a result of development of the social science building, there was a compromise made that no more of those woods would be cut for campus expansion, and that the name John Muir Park would be given to those woods. A statue of John Muir can be seen at Burge Hall. If you enter the main lobby and on the mezzanine level, a bronze statue, which was dedicated in 1916, just a few years after his death, with great pomp and circumstance. Muir was probably the most famous man to come off the UW campus in the first 75 years of the university's history. Along the route between Madison and Portage, you'll find a couple of historical markers that recall Muir's walk back home that he would make during summer breaks between Montello and Madison. One place associated with Muir that I've been researching just recently, which coincides nicely with today's date, in 1863, he goes on his first botanical ramble. He and two friends make their way up to Sauk City and then follow the Wisconsin River down to Prairie du Chien and the Mississippi. And their notion is that they'll go upstream to St. Anthony Falls in Minneapolis.
That's a pretty good paddle.
Well, it was maybe youthful hubris that led them to think that those travels would be possible. His friends injure themselves and get so torn up in traveling down the Wisconsin that they abandon the trip at the mouth of the Mississippi, but not before they try to paddle back up the Wisconsin. They buy a small boat and they're trying vigorously to paddle up the mouth of the Wisconsin where it joins the Mississippi, but the current is too great, and eventually they abandon the boat, but not before they tack a note onto the bow of the boat to a friend in Iowa, and they set the boat adrift. Well, he makes his way back to Madison and arrives around August 1st, 1863, which is almost exactly 150 years ago today. So those of you that float down the Wisconsin River anytime this summer, just imagine 150 years along the banks, John Muir and his buddies botanizing. So after his trip on the Wisconsin, he stops in Madison, and he realizes that his time in Madison has come to an end. And as he starts to walk home, he pauses on the far side of Lake Mendota, and in his autobiography, he writes, "From the top of a hill on the north side of Lake Mendota, I gained a last wistful, lingering view of the beautiful university grounds and buildings where I had spent so many hungry and happy and hopeful days. And there, with streaming eyes, I bade my blessed alma mater farewell. But I was only leaving one university for another, the Wisconsin University, for the University of the Wilderness."
There's some perspective for you from John Muir. Thanks for joining us, Daniel Einstein.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.